This is Old Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
We have Dr. Samuel Gregg back on Church and Culture today. You may recall his name for the past. He is Director of Research at the Acton Institute. He has written extensively, spoken extensively on political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, natural law, and is Doctor of Moral Philosophy and Political Economy under the famous John Finnis, University of Oxford. He's written many books, but he has a new book out from Regnery, which I'm very excited to talk about with him, because it's an important book. It's entitled Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. I think that's a very apt title for this moment in history. Sam Gregg, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Deal. Thank you for having me on. It's good to be with you.
Now, I must say, I was a little surprised at how forthcoming you were at the very beginning of your book, where you just flat out say, getting reason and faith realigned, as it were, and reestablished in our culture is really the key for the future of our Western civilization. Or have I pushed that too much?
No, that is the central thesis of the book. And I basically argue that the West, as we understand that tradition that has developed for 2,500, maybe even longer, years, is centrally dependent upon not just any relationship between reason and faith, but a particular reason and a particular faith that are brought into a type of integration. And that without that integration, without that particular integration of reason and faith, the West can't hold. That the West is so grounded upon this particular relationship, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, that without that relationship, or distortions of that relationship, cannot help but produce tremendous dysfunctionality within Western societies, or what I call pathologies of faith and pathologies of reason. And I think if you look at many of the different philosophical, religious, political challenges that you see all through the West today, whether it's the rise of jihadism, whether it's the spread of what I call liberal religion, whether it's the dominance of scientism, the idea that the empirical sciences are the only way, the only true way to attain knowledge, the dominance of that mindset among many intellectuals, and of course what I call authoritarian relativism. All of those things are in some way a type of pathology of faith or a pathology of reason, and they reflect the breakdown of the integration of reason and faith that took a long time for the West to put together and which has unfolded or slowly started to disintegrate more or less from the Middle Ages onwards. If you don't understand that particular phenomenon, then I don't think you can understand so many of the challenges with which we're faced today.
I really like those chapters on pathologies of faith and reason. I thought those were really, really well stated and important. But I want to begin with a simple fact that you explain very thoroughly and written beautifully, by the way, that the West itself is a product of this particular relation of reason and faith, correct?
Correct. Because many people say any discussion of Western civilization inevitably begins with the question, how do you define the West? And in the first chapter of the book, I spend quite a bit of time unpacking that particular question, because people will say things like, well, the West is about certain institutions, such as rule of law, constitutionalism, or the West is an attachment to particular ideas, whether it's something like freedom or equality or dignity, or the West reflects a certain type of mixture of philosophical positions or religious dispositions, all of which may have something to do with the identity of the West. But I think that core to the very identity of the West, at least as I think that it is understood today, is the notion that human beings are wired for truth, that we can engage in reasoned inquiry in the search of truth, because we possess reason, the same reason that gives us the capacity to master our passions, and that's what leads to true freedom. But all of that, I suggest, this rational inquiry into truth, this emphasis upon freedom as self-mastery, ultimately is highly dependent upon this particular relationship between faith and reason, which in turn, and I'm very clear about this all through the book, is very dependent upon the understanding of God that prevails in a given society. A society that is based upon a vision of God as having the qualities of what the Greeks called logos, which more or less means divine reason, is going to be a very different society than a society that views God as primarily emotion or God as primarily just sheer will. And it's that combination of rational inquiry into truth and the confidence that it can be known, the idea of freedom as self-mastery, and this idea of God is logos that enables this integration of faith and reason to occur, I think that's at the core of what Western civilization is about. What's more, we know that because we see all sorts of dysfunctionality start to emerge when our understanding of God starts to change, or when we start to lack confidence in reason's capacity to know the truth, or when we cease to understand freedom as the idea of self-mastery. All those things, I think, are very, very distinct to Western civilization. I'm not saying that other civilizations don't have glimpses of these things. I'm not saying that other civilizations haven't embodied particular institutions that bear some or even strong resemblance to some of the institutions that exist in the West today. But none of them, I think, have this particular mixture of ideas and this particular understanding of God at their very heart. And that's what makes the West the West.
I think you're very wise, Sam, to have begun the book with a comment on the now infamous speech by Benedict XVI in 2006, which, like you say, the world exploded after September 12, 2006, the Regensburg speech. Could you remind our listeners what it was he said there that got everybody so upset?
Well, I can remember exactly where I was sitting when I read the text and I heard about the text the day that Pope Benedict delivered this address at University of Regensburg, which is where he had taught as a professor for some significant time in his life. And what, of course, enraged some people were comments he made about, well, really a citation of a Byzantine emperor. The Byzantine emperor from the 13th, 14th century was in dialogue with a Muslim correspondent, and basically the emperor said, more or less, that Islam seems to be characterized by habitual violence, and this is a sign of unreasonability. So that's what the Pope did. He quoted a particular Byzantine emperor, and of course this infuriated many people in the Islamic world, and we know that because we saw lots of people rioting. A couple of people ended up being killed as a consequence of this. But what's interesting, I think, is the reaction in the West, because the reaction in the West was either one of, look, the Pope is saying something that everyone, regardless of whether they're Catholic or non-Catholic, believer or non-believer, needs to be paying attention to, or the other reaction was, the Pope shouldn't be talking about these sorts of issues. The Pope should not be saying these sorts of things because it's going to antagonize particular segments of society, And really in the West, we're not in a position to be talking about these things in the first place, and we shouldn't be talking about these things in the first place. And what I think is significant in the longer term about the speech is not actually the reaction in the Muslim world. That was important, that was worrying, it told us some things about a particular trend of thought and practice in the Muslim world. But my own view, and I say this very clearly in the book, is that it was really about us. The speech was not so much directed in the first place to the Islamic world, it was primarily about the West. And if you read the speech, that becomes very, very apparent, because having made these comments or quoted these comments about Islam, the Pope goes on to basically examine in this, this approximately 3,800 words this whole question of the relationship between reason and faith, and he argues that if you want to understand so many of the philosophical and theological problems and conundrums and self-doubt that affects and infects the West today, you need to understand that it's lost sight of the idea of God as logos, which means that it can't put the relationship between reason and faith on any steady foundation. And that, I think, was really the long-term meaning of the text. So while it was initially seen as something that had upset many Muslims, the real recipient, the real intended audience of that speech was us. Those of us who live in the West, Western countries, Western cultures, who identify as Westerners.
Along the way in the book, Sam, and by the way, I want to give the name of the book again. It's Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization, beautifully bound and presented, beautifully written. You quote an old friend of mine, Father Stanley Yockey.
Oh, yes.
Along the way, he used to come to all of our American Meritain meetings. And the one thing that I was so amazed at when I first met him and listened to him and read his books is his argument that the explosion of scientific learning and scientific research would not have been possible without a Christian universe.
Yes.
And in other words, reason is embedded in existence.
Right. Exactly. And one of the things I quote him in the book at one point when he's talking about some questions associated with Darwinism and Darwin's whole approach to questions of the nature of God. But the book also makes the claim that the Greeks, of course, had developed some of the basic foundations of the modern sciences. Plato played a significant role in this regard. But one of the things I argue in the book is that the Greeks were trapped because, in a sense, they were developing what we would call the physical sciences today, things like mathematics, biology, chemistry, physics, etc. They were arriving at some very profound insights into the natural world. But there was a problem, and the problem was they're frankly stupid religions because it's the insights that they were gaining into the order that permeates the world, that they, their natural reason was apprehending as they studied and tried to think about questions of physics, of biology, of mathematics, the things that are so important in understanding the natural world. They couldn't reconcile these insights with their conception of religion and their conception of the divine, because the Greek religions, they weren't rational faiths. They didn't pretend to be rational faiths. They were based upon an understanding of the universe as being in constant churn. There's no beginning, there's no end, it's just this constant churn. And the destiny of human beings is very much a matter of fate. There's really nothing you can do, which means you don't really have any freedom in any real sense. But also, the Greek gods, who were they? They were these very human-like beings who spent most of their time doing terrible, sometimes mischievous, but sometimes deadly things to each other, but also they messed around with the lives of human beings. So these were highly irrational, selfish, self-centered, highly unpleasant beings. What's more, they weren't characterized by reason. They weren't characterized by this idea of logos that we discussed before.
No, it was jealousy and pride.
Exactly, exactly. And so this understanding of the religious world and religious questions was simply impossible to reconcile with many of the insights into reality that they were realizing as a consequence of applying their reason to the natural world. Now, there were some Greeks, like Socrates, for example, and Aristotle, who made these sort of subtle criticisms of the pagan religions, and they were edging closer towards this idea of God as logos. But they couldn't get there. They couldn't get there because of the blinders, if you like, of the Greek pagan religions.
Don't you think Aristotle got there with his conception of God as the good?
Yes, and also his conception of God as eternal cause as well.
Yeah. So you see, I mean, he didn't get all the way there, but he at least had a teleological view of human action.
And he did. Now, one difference, I think, is that he has a conception of choice, but he doesn't have a strong conception of what Judaism really first realized, which is this idea of free choice, that there are choices that we make in which the decision is really, really truly a consequence of us willing X rather than Y. And that's something that Aristotle lacked.
So it sort of prefigures Kant.
Well, it does. It's a type of soft determinism in a way.
A rationalism.
That too. And what you find with, of course, Judaism is this very, very different thing. And in fact, I say in the book that the Jews really arrived at a much more coherent conception of God, the nature of creation, the nature of human beings, and the nature of the created world. You know, 500, 600
yes.
years.
Very good point.
Really started doing this. And this is yeah. why in one of the chapters, one of the subheadings is called The Miracle of the Jews. Because they were really the first to do this. So when the Hebrew prophets, when they challenged the idolatry that was all around them and which many Israelites were succumbing to, they were saying it is irrational. It simply makes no sense to be sacrificing animals, let alone human beings, to things that are made of wood and stone or just happen to look beautiful. And this was really an insight into rationality and their conception of God. Now, the Jews had a conception of God. God was tough. God was sometimes unpredictable. God would punish when he thought people had done the wrong thing. But it wasn't an unreasonable God. This was not, the Jewish God was not a God who just played around with people's lives. He acted with purpose. And his creation of the world is deliberate and by design. Now, of course, what happens, and I talk about this in the book at some length, is you have an encounter between the Greek world, which have these ridiculous religions, but nonetheless these insights into philosophy and the natural sciences, and they encounter the Jewish world, which has this much more rational, more comprehensible conception of the nature of God and therefore of the nature of creation.
What about Heraclitus and his notion of logos? You're really right where I began my journey in philosophy and theology at the University of Texas as an undergraduate. I became fascinated with the logos from the prologue
right.
of the Gospel of John, and whether that came from the Greeks, came out of the Greek tradition, or did it somehow combine with, and I think you're suggesting strongly, with a Judaistic conception of God, which was, as you put it, it was providential, it was personal, it was it had a structure in a way that the, as you've put it, the Homeric gods and Hesiodic gods didn't have.
Right, and I think what's really important here is this word logos, because this is a Greek word, and it means many different things in Greek, but by the 4th, 3rd century, it was one of the most used words in the Greek world.
Right.
And this is important because you find people like Philo of Alexandria, who's the first century Jewish philosopher and Roman citizen and Roman politician, who's using these Greek words like logos to try and convey both to Greeks, but also to Greek-speaking Jews, because by this stage, a lot of diaspora Jews had basically lost the capacity to speak in everyday language in Hebrew. People like this were using this language of logos to try and explain to the Greeks, so you have this sort of appropriation by some of these Jewish thinkers. They're taking the word logos and saying, okay, this is what it means. This is who our conception of God is. And it's also important because there's another word which is very significant in this context, and it's the whole idea of dabhar. Dabhar is a Hebrew word which means, it means word, but it also means a sort of actor, someone who's active in history.
Could you spell that out for us?
Yeah, well, basically,
how would you spell it?
Let me just check so I make sure. It's D-A-B-H-A-R.
Okay.
And what this really means is that God is not a type of passive being. God is not a passive being. He is the Word, and the Word is active. If the Israelites used this word to describe how God, Yahweh, had made his essence reconcilable and recognizable to human beings. So Dabhar, D-A-B-H-A-R, it's not a force of nature. It's not the natural world. It's the function of a conscious and moral personality. And this was very important because it meant that the Jewish God, Yahweh, was not a personified force of nature. It was the act, not of lots of different things, it was the act of one mind. And this had strong parallels with the Greek idea of logos.
And you have the Exodus moment when God reveals himself to Moses as, and it depends on how you want to translate it, but it's basically, I am who I am.
Right, being, I am being. And this being is not static. This being is active and moving in the world. So when, so here's the thing, I mean, you mentioned the Gospel of John. When it begins, and the Greek begins, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word, John is doing this very, very deliberately because he's trying to convey to Greek-speaking audiences, both Hellenic but also Jewish, these Greek-speaking audiences, something about the nature of the God first revealed in the Hebrew Scriptures to the Hebrew prophets at a particular time and place, that has now made himself fully known in the person, the Word, himself personified, Jesus Christ. So when Hellenic Jewish audiences heard John using this word, logos, it also meant dabhar to them. It also meant this idea of this conscious, moral, active personality.
So it's not a logos that is abstract. It's not an abstract logos.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Static is the word I was
looking for. Logos that's active, and it's not like the God that some deist thinkers had in mind, which is a God who sort of winds up the world, sets it in motion, and then just sits back and watches. Logos implies a God that's the creator, the beginning of time, who sets things in motion, but it continues to be active in human history,
and would it be fair to say that you can only, that reason alone cannot access the logos, and faith does two things, and I'm kind of going a little off your book, and I'm going to ask you if I've come to the right conclusion, that faith on the one hand accesses the logos as a matter of a proposition that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word, those are propositions. And so you access those through faith, but reason takes up those propositions as true, and then in all the different ways we reason, all the degrees of knowledge, we are reasoning on the basis of that one fact, that God is the Word, and the Word became flesh.
Yes, and what's particularly interesting about Christianity, and even more particularly about Catholicism, is that it insists that you can know God through reason alone. You can know God. You can't know everything, but you can know and reason that there is a creator.
Yeah, I love that quote from Vatican I you pulled out on that.
Well, they were very explicit. The Vatican Council was very explicit about this, that you can know God under the volition of your reason. And that won't tell you everything about, for example, the scriptures, but it will tell you that not just that God is real, that there is a creator, that this is a much more reasonable argument than, say, atheism or pantheism, but also that the Christian God is a reasonable God, and that the scriptures, when they present themselves, what's fascinating about them is that there's no mythology. There's no mythology in the Christian scriptures. This is all based upon evidence, things that were said, this person who people knew, met, talked about, observed doing these miraculous things. None of this is completely different from, for example, the Greek world, where everything is about mythology when it comes to religion.
I'm talking with Dr. Samuel Gregg, Director of Research at the Acts Institute, about his new book, From Regnery, which I strongly recommend, Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. When we come back after a short break, we're going to move to the Enlightenment, and we're going to ask questions about what the Enlightenment's relationship was to faith, to religion. Did it totally reject those things? And particularly the influence of the Enlightenment on the American founding. We'll be back with those very interesting questions after a short break.
Join Young Catholic Professionals, YCP, one of the nation's fastest growing apostolates, to launch their Detroit chapter's third year on Wednesday, July 21st at St. Joseph Oratory in Detroit. The fun starts at 7 p.m. with drinks, appetizers, and music, followed by a speaker and YCP Board Chair Matt Barrett. YCP programs help young people at every stage of their journey grow with Catholics and professionals. See ycpdetroit.org or YCP Detroit on Facebook.
Ave Maria Radio is having a Christmas in July sale going on right now at AveMariaRadio.net. Deck your halls with great books, talks, and other products for friends, family, and even for yourself. Products featuring Father John Ricardo are on sale, including a 20% discount on all single show copies of Christ is the Answer. Just apply the promo code CIAJULY19 at checkout. Don't miss out on Ave Maria Radio's Christmas in July sale going on right now at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts. Questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Father John Ricardo continues a new series on our next edition of Christ is the Answer. After going through the Alpha Course, many of his parishioners wanted more for a still closer walk with our Lord. On the third episode of The Next Necessary Step, Father Ricardo's title is Suffering. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the answer.
Christ is the answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Back with Dr. Samuel Gregg, whose new book, Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization, has got me very excited. I read it in one sitting, actually, starting this morning and up until now. We got Sam on the phone. It's a very readable book. You'll like it. Sam, it seems to me after you've sort of shown us the way in which this reasonable God, as you put it, was the foundation for the creation of what we know as the West, at least up until the Renaissance. You then move to the Enlightenment, and you begin to question a lot of the assumptions that a lot of people have about what the Enlightenment symbolizes. I mean, it represents a kind of move away from faith, move away from religion, and so forth. But you say not so fast.
I do. And there's many reasons for this. One is that the Enlightenment, or more properly, the Enlightenment, because as you know, there was more than one. There was a German Enlightenment, an early French Enlightenment, a late French Enlightenment, a Scottish Enlightenment, a Scandinavian Enlightenment. There was even an Irish Enlightenment. They're all not the same thing. They're all somewhat different in their emphases and focus. So that's one thing. The second thing is that many of the people that we associate with Enlightenment, this sort of movement of ideas about improvement, of subjecting everything to rational, critical analysis, to the employment of the empirical method, etc., most of these people were not anti-religious. In fact, most of them were believers of one sort or another. And I don't mean by that deists. I mean people who were actually believing Christians, believing Jews. The prime example, of course, is the hero of Enlightenment, Isaac Newton. Deeply religious man. Now, he had some views that you or I would consider heterodox, especially when it came to the Trinity. But he was not a deist. He plainly understood himself to be a Christian and saw the whole scientific enterprise as underpinned for its very rationality, its very sustainability, upon a particular understanding of God as the creator who's active and alive and working in history, who holds everything into place. And you go through the different enlightenments, and what do you find? Well, you find people who are skeptics, like, for example, David Hume, who's clearly a skeptic, a self-described infidel. But then you have, for example, 18th century Jesuits, who are very orthodox in their faith, but they're not afraid of the natural sciences. They're not afraid of engaging and dialoguing with and discussing and even critiquing and spreading some of the new learning that was going on at that particular point in time. And it's also, I think, quite clear that to talk about the Enlightenment marking this sudden break with the early modern and medieval world, even that, I think, is more questionable. I think many of these things are much more fluid and there's much more continuity than we often realize. Now, that said, there were some trends of Enlightenment thought that I think did help to facilitate some of the pathologies of faith and the pathologies of reason that I identify in some of the later chapters.
Yeah, who are the villains?
Well, I mean, you have to ask yourself the question of whether this was intended or whether this was sort of an unintended consequence. I'm inclined to think that at least initially some of this was an unintended consequence. So you have people like Francis Bacon, who's clearly, he describes himself as a believer who's a critic, a fierce critic of atheism, and says atheism is basically ridiculous. And yet he uses the scientific method in ways that clearly suggest that he thinks that this is the primary way of understanding the world if you want to change the world, if you want to change things around you, if you want to improve things.
You talked about his ideal was reason that could be utilized.
Right. And, you know, that's not something that medieval Christians and Jews were opposed to. Far from it. They used their reason all the time to try and understand and improve life around them. But they also had a vision of reason as explaining why you wanted to improve the world in the first place and how human beings acting in the world, how that fitted into a wider, bigger plan for humanity and the universe. And what you see in parts of the Enlightenment is a narrowing of the focus, a narrowing of the focus of reason. So that, for example, when people sit down and talk about, I don't know, physics, for example, or when they gathered in many of these academies and coffee houses that started to emerge, it wasn't that they were anti-religious. It wasn't that they weren't interested in theological questions. They just thought that when you were discussing physics or chemistry or engineering, that you didn't bring a theological question to the table. That was the way that they thought about these things. So these people who are engaging in these discussions, they're overwhelmingly religious people. And as I said, I don't mean by that deists. I mean people who are active, believing Jews and Christians, who believe what the scriptures say about the nature of God, but who are interested in applying critical reason and the empirical method to improve the world. Now, as I said, there are some of these things took off in a particular direction that were going to have some very negative implications. But in other cases, I think, they actually, we have to ask ourselves, here's a question to ask ourselves, is something like this. Would the West have really arrived at strong conceptions of religious liberty without the concern that particular Enlightenment thinkers had about questions of religious toleration? Or to take another one, would the West have arrived at really strong, robust understandings of why economic liberty is important if we hadn't had, say, Adam Smith and his Wealth of Nations? I'm skeptical. I say in the book, I'm skeptical whether we would have got there without the impetus of this particular way of thinking about the world. But as I said, there's also some negative implications following from some of these developments. Scientism, because when you start to narrow, for example, the scope of reason to the empirical sciences, it's not long before people start saying, okay, well, really, this is the only way we can understand the world, and everything else is just a matter of subjective preference. Or when you start saying the primary, one of the main functions of reason is to increase utility, to change the world around us for the better, it's not long before some people start saying, well, can't we use the same empirical method to improve human nature? Can't we change human nature through using the same empirical method? So you can see how my book basically argues when it comes to the different enlightenments, and of course the enlightenment of what so many people in the West associate with reason today. When you look at the enlightenments, when you look at the complexity of these different sets of thinkers and the different trajectories, the different streams of thought had, I basically argue there's a lot of good in the enlightenment, there's also a lot of negativity in the Enlightenment. And in many respects, those are some of the questions that we're struggling with today. I find it remarkable, for example, that if you read the person we mentioned before, Benedict XVI, Joseph Ratzinger, when you read many of his writings, his starting point of reference is not the Middle Ages, sometimes it's not even the Scriptures. More often than not, he begins with the Enlightenment. And he makes many of the same distinctions that we've been talking about today. So he says, for example, look, there's clearly a major distinction between, let's call it the Anglo-American experience of enlightenment and the late French experience of enlightenment. The late French experience of enlightenment moves quickly in the direction of trying to redesign society from the top down.
Talking about Helvetius and Auguste Comte.
That's right, and Derrida and people who were quite anti-religious, who viewed religion as superstition and it had to be disposed of at best. Some of them were deists at best. And on the other hand, in the Anglo-American, or let's call it the Anglo-Scottish-American experience of enlightenment, Christians and Christian, and including Christian clergy, are at the very heart of the whole thing. If you look, for example, at the Scottish Enlightenment, which exerted a profound influence on the United States. There were people like Hume, who were skeptics. You had people like Adam Smith, who was probably a deist. But most of the people involved in the Scottish Enlightenment were ministers of the Church of Scotland who took their faith very, very seriously. And when you look at the United States, the American colonies before 1776, you find that among the most zealous promoters of the empirical method and incorporation of Enlightenment techniques into educational curriculum, guess what? They're clergy for the most part. And these people did not see any necessary conflict between using some of the insights and methodologies refined and developed by the Enlightenment and Christian faith. Whereas, as I said, the experience in France, particularly towards the end of the 18th century, was very, very different. You see reason lining up. The forces of the self-described forces of reason lining up against the self-described forces of faith. In the United States, in North America, you don't have that conflict. Yes, you do have people like, say, Franklin and Jefferson who are clearly some sort of dais, and clearly not at all Orthodox Christians. But when you look at the American founding, you see this sort of very judicious mixture of Orthodox Christian thought, of Greco-Roman thinking, and Enlightenment thought. And that, for example, for Joseph Ratzinger, is a much healthier, much more potentially productive set of circumstances and arrangements than what you find, for example, in much continental European Enlightenment thinking.
Let me just interrupt and ask this question. I just finished reading Gordon Wood's book on Jefferson and Adams. And one thing he brought out that I didn't know about, but I found fascinating, and your book touches on it, is how each of them reacted to the French Revolution.
Right.
That Jefferson kept, you know, would never admit that it kind of that it went very bad. And that Adams said, was saying, I told you so, I told you so. And
he wasn't the only one either.
He wasn't the only one. But they had both witnessed. They had both been there.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And I mean, this I think, demonstrates your point about plural, Enlightenment's plural.
Yes, because when you look at some of the different effects of Enlightenment thinking, the different emphases, so what you find, for example, in the Anglo-American Enlightenment, it's much more a sort of bottom-up process. There's a social science going on, but it's not seen as having an anti-religious agenda. Whereas in France, particularly by the late 18th century, it's very much about efforts to redesign society from the top down. It's very skeptical about the claims of Orthodox religion. Religion is seen as superstition. Religion is seen as for the weak, etc. But I think so. My point is that many Christians, and you and I know people like this, are inclined to look at the Enlightenment and say it's all bad. There's nothing here for Christians to be interested in. This is all downhill from now on. These people are the enemy, etc. Well, and my point is, yes, there is a fair amount of anti-religious, anti-Christian sentiment in particular streams of Enlightenment thought with particular Enlightenment thinkers, but they are not, that's not the whole story.
That's not the mainstream.
No, it's not. It's certainly not. And I think we know more about those other streams, those more negative streams that produce some of, for example, the barbarisms that followed the French Revolution, precisely because they produce such.
But that barbarism had nothing to do with the Enlightenment. It went contrary to it.
Well, this is the thing, of course, because people would point out at the time that, particularly when things like the Terror got underway in France in the early 1790s, people would point out, isn't this interesting? You said that the Enlightenment was going to bring us light. It was going to make the world better. But now you seem to be killing each other.
Yes.
So it wasn't just aristocrats who were being executed. It was also anyone who really didn't buy into a particular way of thinking about the world. And that was contradictory.
Yeah, it's at one point
emphasis upon toleration.
At one point, you use the phrase moral totalitarianism.
Absolutely,
that's definitely what was going on during the Terror.
And that's what you find that many people at the time started to say was that, aren't you contradicting basic Enlightenment commitment to things like toleration? Because they were all about toleration. They talked about toleration endlessly. Now, it's not the same way that we talked about it. There were things that they would not tolerate that not today that are tolerated. But when people started seeing some of these enlightened people doing terrible things, not just to their perceived enemies but to each other, that's when you start to see people are saying, well, maybe we need to make some distinctions here. So even in the late 18th century, you find in America, you find clerics using Enlightenment terms and language, and yet also condemning people like Rousseau and Voltaire because they're seen as harbingers of some of the destruction that was going on across the Atlantic.
Yeah, you think of a figure like Danton being marched to the guillotine. And, of course, that famous scene, which has been portrayed beautifully in several films, at the trial. When he just puts Robespierre on trial.
Right. And what you find, of course, with some of these particular streams of Enlightenment thought, of course, it very quickly, once some of these people got their hands on the lever of power, it very quickly moved in an anti-religious direction. That's certainly the case with the French Revolution. But by contrast, the American Revolution never had an anti-religious dimension to it. Even people like Jefferson, who's some sort of deist, he clearly has reservations and problems with many aspects of Christianity, especially the supernatural claims. So he's not calling for the execution of clergy. He's not calling for the establishment of a temple to divine reason inside local churches or anything like that. He's not calling for any of those sorts of things. So even people in America, in the experience of the American Enlightenment, those who did tend to move away from Orthodox Christian belief, they didn't embrace the sort of in principle anti-religion position that you find in much of the French Revolution.
And even in the early months of the French Revolution, a large group of those supporting the revolutionaries were clergy.
Right, because they had read all the same books that everyone else had. In fact, Tocqueville, in his book L'Ancien Régime et la Révolution, he says on the eve of the French Revolution that France had never had a more engaged, intellectually engaged, and educated clergy at any other point in its history. So you find, for example, in the mid-18th century, Jesuits engaging with some of these Enlightenment philosophers and saying, okay, well, we think you have a point there, but you're wrong about that. That's what you would expect to happen in a modern university, for example. But what you find, of course, is that these people were very, very well educated. The clergy were usually among the most educated people in these societies, right? Because they had to be if they were going to perform these sorts of functions in society. They were very familiar with Enlightenment thought, and they had reservations about some of it. In other parts, they saw no problem.
Now, we have about 10 minutes left, and I want you to go through for our listeners the pathologies you talk about. I'm particularly interested in the pathologies of faith, but could you go over that material for a second?
Sure. Well, in Chapter 3 and Chapter 4, I basically look at, or in Chapter 5, I should say, I look at the different pathologies that have been let loose in the West as a consequence of this breakdown of the integration of faith and reason. And so you have, what's a pathology of religion? A prominent example of a pathology of religion is Marxism. I mean, it's the most obvious one. The Jesuit philosopher of history, Frederick Copleston, once said that he thought that one of the reasons why Marxism managed to outlast and stay alive compared to many other 19th century philosophies was because Marxism, he said, had all the characteristics of a faith. So you think about it. It has sacred books. It has prophets, Marx and Engels. I mean, Marx even looks like a Hebrew prophet who springs from the pages of the Bible. It has a church. It's called the Communist Party. It has an ecclesiastical hierarchy. You know, you have party members, and you have the secretary, you have the general secretary, you have the Politburo, etc. It has martyrs and saints. People like Che Guevara are treated in this particular type of way. It has the Orthodox, and then it has the heretics. So when you look at these things, what you discover is that Marxism even takes a religious understanding of history. It says there is an end time, just like Christianity does. So that's an example of a pathology of faith. An example of a pathology of reason would be scientism. The idea that the only sure knowledge that we can have is what is empiric, can be empirically measured. And the only way that we can know these things is through using the empirical method of deduction. That's the only way in which we can know truth. So philosophy is subjective, theology is subjective, everything is subjective, except the sciences. The problem, of course, is that the sciences can't answer moral questions. It can't provide political answers. So the sciences can tell you, whether it's a social science or an economic or a natural science, it can tell you how to cure diseases. But I can't tell you why you would want to do that in the first place. The science of economics can provide us with enormous insights into how you create wealth. But I can't tell you what to do with that wealth once you obtained it and how you should correctly order your use and attainment of wealth vis-a-vis all your other responsibilities. So what you see there is the pathology of reason. It takes an aspect of reason, the empirical method, which of course is very powerful. It's told us a lot about the world and made the world a better place in many respects. But you can't use that to understand things that it's not capable of measuring, it's not capable of knowing. Another pathology of religion would be what I call liberal religion, what John Henry Newman called liberal religion. And that's when you take religion and you throw reason out. So you no longer have God, a God of love, who is also a God of reason. You just have a God of love. And a God of love without reason is nothing other than a great big teddy bear who does right. nothing but affirm us, tell us we're wonderful, he never challenges us, and you can act and allows us to act in highly irrational, often destructive ways. And you, when you look at how Newman describes liberal religion, the pathology that is at work there is very much flowing from the idea that religion is purely subjective, reason has nothing to do with religion, so everything to do with religion is about emotion, it's about feelings, it's about sentiment. And just look at the state of Christianity in Western countries today.
Well, look at liberal Protestantism has gone completely down that road.
Of course, and there are many Catholics have gone down that road as well. Many Jews have gone down that road as well. It's the same sort of phenomena. I could go on, but these pathologies, what they all have in common is a separation in some way of reason and faith, or an exaggeration of aspects of reason, or an exaggeration of aspects of faith. I mean, I think jihadism, it's clearly a pathology of religion because it involves throwing reason out the door.
Well, it's a form of the terror.
Right. I mean, when you think about, and I spent some time talking about the phenomena of Islamic jihadism, what is it at its root? What is its root is a particular understanding of God. God is just pure will. The same God who could command us to do things that are strictly irrational, as Benedict said in his Regensburg address. And when you think about jihadism, what you quickly realize is that it's vitally dependent upon this idea that God is pure will and that this will can command you to do unreasonable things like fly planes into buildings or drive trucks into crowds of people in southern France. So that's an example of a pathology of religion, precisely because its conception of God is deeply, deeply problematic. It's just as problematic as the idea of God that lies at the heart of liberal religion. So these pathologies, I'm not saying
Sam,
these are the only way to.
We've got about a minute left, and I want you, but I want you to wrap. Give us a good wrap up comment.
Good wrap up comment is that most books about Western civilization fall into two categories. One, they're either highly pessimistic, they view the West as corrupt, it's better that it goes away. There are others that say, well, the West was good, but it's over, it's done. And my argument is, if we can get this relationship between reason and faith right, we can have every confidence that Western civilization can be renewed. So in that sense, the book ends on an optimistic note. And I think that's very...
It's a wonderful book, and it's a great first step toward any reader recapturing how reason and faith should properly align. It's from Regner, and it's entitled Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. Sam Gregg, we really appreciate your coming back on Church and Culture.
Deal. Thanks for having me. It's always good to talk with you.
And we'll be back this time and day next week with great guests. Please join us.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.